This morning, I want to talk to you about a character that we don't talk about just a whole lot. Now, if this doesn't work, I don't know what we're going to do, to be honest with you. But technology is not always my strong suit, so we're going to try to see if this will work. Maybe not. Hang on. There comes something. The title of my lesson is not "Please Silence All Cell Phones and Other Activities," I promise. Hopefully we'll see if something works. If not, that's okay. We'll just move on without it. I want to talk to you about a character this morning that you don't always talk about just a whole lot. We know his name. We've known his name our entire lives. Ever since we were really, 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 really small, we remember talking about this particular character. If most of you remember, we used to talk about Abraham. We talked about Abraham a lot. I can remember growing up as a small child hearing the story of Abraham. Now, I was always confused because, as the Bible points out, his name was actually Abram, and then it was changed to Abraham. And I remember being a small child, being confused by that, having two different names. It was really strange to me. But we told the story of Abraham an awful lot. Abraham, going, when God told him to go, he went. And in Genesis chapter 12, we're told that God told Abram just to pack up everything and go. And I remember the older that I've gotten, I think, there's no way I could do that. If God just somehow sent me a message and said, "Scott, I want you to pack up everything and I want you to move," that would be fine with me as long as I knew the destination. The problem with Abram is God didn't tell him where. He just said, "Pack up and leave." Now, he was leaving a place that he had grown up his entire life. Pack up and leave. And he did so. We're told the story of Abram about him sacrificing his son, or almost sacrificing his son. We're told the story of all different types of things that Abraham did. We're told the story of Jacob. Jacob and Esau. We're told the story of these twin boys and what they did and how Jacob was a little bit more shrewd, perhaps, than Esau. We're told the story of Jacob and Laban when Jacob had to work for Laban for 14 years just to marry the lady that he wanted to marry. We're told about how Jacob's name was changed after wrestling with an angel all night long. We're told the story of Jacob, now known as Israel, and his 12 sons, and the story of Joseph. You know what's interesting is, there's a person in between those two. That honestly, we're told really two major stories about. In one, he is nearly sacrificed by his own father upon an altar. In the other story, he's tricked by his own son and made to look very foolish. There's a story about Isaac, though, that I want to talk about today. Isaac's a really interesting person, and what's interesting about him is that in the New Testament, you're told something very specific about him. I want you to take your Bible and turn to Galatians chapter 4. Galatians chapter 4. There's something really interesting in Galatians chapter 4 about Isaac, who, I hate to say this, might be the lesser known of those three major characters that we study. In Galatians chapter 4, beginning in verse 21, Paul says, "Tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not listen to the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by a slave woman and one by a free woman. But the son of the slave was born according to the flesh, while the son of the free woman was born through promise." Now, this may be interpreted allegorically, that these men are two covenants. One is from Mount Sinai, bearing children for slavery. She is Hagar. Now, Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia. She corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free, and she is our mother. For it is written, "Rejoice, O barren one who does not bear. Break forth and cry aloud, you who are not in labor. For the children of the desolate one will be more than those of the one who has a husband." Now you, brothers, like Isaac, are children of promise. But just as at that time he who was born according to the flesh persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit, so also it is now. But what does the Scripture say, verse 30 says? "Cast out the slave woman and her son, for the son of the slave woman shall not inherit with the son of the free woman. So, brothers, we are not children of the slave, but of the free woman." Something is told to you about Isaac in Galatians chapter 4 that we're not told in any account of his in Genesis. Oh, sure, we're told the story of him being a promised child. We're told the story of Abraham being promised in Genesis chapter 12 that on his offspring all nations would be blessed. We're even told the story when you get over into Genesis 16 that Hagar and Ishmael are seen as sort of the outcasts of the family. And perhaps you could say even rightfully so, as God had promised Abraham that through you all generations will be blessed. And then Abraham and Sarah took it upon themselves to try to execute that promise. You're told so much about Abraham's involvement in that story, but perhaps we forget at times that there's something to be learned from Isaac's part of the story. You see, he was a child of promise. And what's interesting is, if you read Galatians chapter 5 and verse 1, Paul brings all those things that he just mentioned into one thought. In Galatians 5:1, he says, "For freedom Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery." I'll be honest with you, there are times that my family and I will go out to eat. And we'll get to the place and I have to choose between a couple of different options. And it's hard sometimes because, you know, both options sound really good. So you think about it and you think, well, do I want chicken or steak? Now, both may be fantastic, but you got to choose one. There have been plenty of times probably in your life that you've been faced with a choice. And what's really interesting to me is that if you look at a child even, that if you look at a small child and you say, "I want you to choose between choice A and choice B," even a small child doesn't look at you and go, "You know what, actually, I think I'll create my own choice C. Now deal with that." Doesn't happen. Even a small child goes, "Okay, you've given me two choices." Here's what I think is fascinating. Galatians chapter 4 indicates that there are two choices in the way to live your life. Either you will choose to connect yourself to the slave child, if you will, the child born into slavery, as Galatians 5:1 says, the yoke of slavery, or you will choose to be a child of freedom, a child of promise. To me, there's only two choices. I don't read that passage, and I've read and reread this passage I don't know how many times. I don't see a third option. Now, that's really difficult for some people to understand. Now, namely because they don't want to understand it, first of all. Because, you see, if you acknowledge the fact that there are only two choices and you don't make the correct one, then, well, you have to admit that you're wrong. And we all know that that's very difficult for most people to do. I will tell you that one of the hardest things for me to do is to tell anybody that I was wrong. I struggle with that. For some reason, we've just sort of been taught in our society and in America at large that it's really difficult for us to admit that we messed up. It's very hard for us to accept personal responsibility when we really mess things up. It's almost easier for us just to say, well, one of two things. Either it didn't happen or it was somebody else's fault. As a coach, I always find it interesting when a mistake is made out on the court. I always find it interesting to watch the guys that were involved. You know, sometimes you'll have the guy that will pat his chest and he'll say, it was my fault, my fault, my fault. I had a kid this past year, that was my point guard on my basketball team. And I have video evidence, and I showed this to him, and he was absolutely mortified. But I showed him several mistakes that he made in one particular game. And he said, "Yeah, that was my fault." I said, "Yes, but watch your body language after the mistake was made. Everybody in the gym knows it's your fault. I, as the coach, absolutely know it's your fault. Even your parents know it's your fault. Everybody in the gym knows it's your fault." And we watched on film as he threw the ball out of bounds. I'm talking about not even close to anybody on our team. And the ball was thrown at about 200 miles an hour where nobody could have caught it. It would have gone through one of our players had he actually been there. He goes flying into the bleachers, and he looks at his teammate and does this. Now, his teammate is 25 feet from the basketball. And he goes, And then does this. Now I said, I want you to explain to me what this means. Because the first thought I had is those old Bugs Bunny cartoons. When the bad guy would come up to Bugs Bunny wearing some type of disguise and he would say, which way did he go? And Bugs would do this. That's the first thing I thought of. I said, what are you doing? He said, well, I thought he was going to cut. I said, which way? Because you're pointing both. Sometimes you have those types of mistakes. You make blatant mistakes. But it's how you respond to those. Do you say, it's my fault. I take responsibility for my actions. And whatever consequences come from those actions. I'll embarrass her because she's not in here. Carabeth is 5 now. She's gone to school all year. And it's been really interesting for Rachel and I to watch how she's kind of grown up a little bit through this first year of school. But one of the things that she really struggles with is that when she is in trouble for something, she will not say, yes, I'm sorry, I did that. She won't do it. It doesn't matter if I walked into the kitchen and she was neck deep in the cookie jar with cookie crumbs all over her face. If I walked in and said, are you eating those cookies? She would say, mm-mm. Mm-mm. Well, Carabeth, you are in the cookie jar with cookie crumbs all over. But dad. That's her response to everything. But mom. Now, I'll tell you right now, she's 5 going on 15, and I am in trouble for the next 10 years. I will tell you that up front. Actually, for about the next, 13, 14, 15, maybe 20 years, probably. But that's her response. You get caught red-handed, but wait, it's not me. Wait, you don't understand. See, Tucker came through and threw me into the cookie jar. And he made me eat all these cookies. It wasn't me. So many people do the same thing. They meander through their life, and when they do something they know they're not supposed to do, and somebody calls them on it, but you don't understand. You don't know what it's like to be me. You don't understand how hard it is to be me. And excuse after excuse after excuse. How about when Moses was asked to go to Egypt and to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? Moses could have just simply said, yes, Lord, I'll go. If you want me to go, that's what I'll do. But what did he do instead? What did he do? Every excuse under the sun, wasn't it? Lord, I'm too old. Nope, you're not too old. Go. I don't know if I can do this. You can do it. Go. But I don't talk all that well. I could say that, right? A lot of us could probably go, well, you know, I don't have the mastery of the English language. I don't speak all that clearly. Hey, look, my technology's gonna work now. Probably not. Oh, look, I got to enter things. This is not good. Oh, it broke. That's good. I always like it when things break. That's always fantastic. Moses says, I don't speak all that clearly. God says, take Aaron. Aaron speaks really clearly. Just tell him what to say. Finally, what happens? Moses runs out of excuses. Finally, Moses just runs out of excuses, and he finally says what he should have said to start with, right? Yes, Lord, I'll go. To be honest with you, on the day of judgment, the time for excuses will be long gone. As a matter of fact, Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7 that when it comes right down to it, on the day of judgment, there are going to be people that are going to look at God and they're going to say, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, cast out evil spirits, heal people? Didn't we do all these things in your name? And God is going to say, depart from me. Listen now, listen very carefully. I never knew you. I didn't catch on to that until just a few years ago, rereading all the Sermon on the Mount. I didn't catch on to that. I'm not real bright. I'll tell you that right up front. I'm not real bright, so I don't catch sometimes some of these little the things, the way things are written. the wording. That blew me away the first time I saw that. Not that God said, I don't know you. It's that He said, I never knew you. That's what caught my attention. Here are people that said, Lord, we've done all these things in your name. And God says, get away from me. I've never known who you are. And it got me to thinking. Is this a problem that could have been solved a long time ago? Certainly. And it brought me back to where we are today, which is there were two choices in that person's life. A choice of slavery and a choice of freedom. And they chose slavery even when they went to church. You're telling me that people can come and sit in the pews and sing songs and close their eyes and read their Bible and partially listen when the guy's up there talking. And they can take the Lord's Supper and they can go get in their cars and they can go home and still be lost. Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, they can do all of those things and God could have never known them. That's fascinating. And what that tells me is that the choice that you have to make, that I have to make, at some point in our lives, and for most everyone, I would say everyone in here, you've already reached that point where you've had to make that choice. Are you going to choose what Paul refers to as the way of the slave, or are you going to choose the way of the free? Now, very quickly, let me tell you something about the way of the slave. If you go to 1 John chapter 2, and this is a familiar passage, this is nothing new, you know this passage, you could probably quote it before I could even finish reading it. 1 John chapter 2, beginning in verse 15. John wrote these words. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and the pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires. But whoever does the will of God abides forever. Again, familiar passage, but here's what I found out from that. Here's what I read into that. Here's what I think you can apply to what we're talking about from that. Is that the way of a slave is really simple. It's outlined by John. It's the lust of the eyes, the desires of the eyes. The lust of the flesh, the desires of the flesh, and the pride of life. Now, some translations say the pride in one's possessions. I think it's pretty standard and pretty simple for you to understand where we're going with this. The way of the slave is, how about I am in love with the things that I see? The lust of the eyes. The idea that I can easily be distracted. I was watching a commercial just the other day, and it was a commercial where they said, whatever you do, don't stop watching the screen. It was about 6 or 8 people sitting in this room together. And they said, whatever you do, do not look away from this screen. So they hit play, and on this screen is a section of road. Section of road, just road. Playing on a video, on a loop. And while they're sitting there, they sit there for a few seconds. Some puppies, they let some puppies loose in the room with them. And the puppies are running around the room. And I used to notice that 2 or 3 of the people in there, they look down and they pet the puppies and they pick one of them up and they do all this. So then the next thing is this guy comes into the room and he trips and just falls right beside him. And you see 3 or 4 people look around to see if he's okay. And then the last thing is these 2 wrestlers come bursting through the wall. And you see everybody turns and looks at that point. And the commercial was for distracted driving. And the point that this person that was doing this experiment said is, every single one of you looked away for an average of about 5 or 6 seconds to what was around you. Some of you longer than that. And this person made the point that as soon as you did that, you took your eyes off the road. And all it takes is about 0.5 seconds for your car to lose control. And they said you were looking away for 5, 6, 7, maybe even 10 seconds you looked away from the road. Now you think about that. The point is very obvious. You know, when you're behind the wheel of a car and you're driving down the road, if you're looking at everything all around you, then the people that are driving in front of you, around you, they're in danger. Well, guess what? The spiritual is no different. The spiritual is no different. If you read Matthew 7 very closely, God says, Jesus says, that the way to get into heaven is the straight and narrow way. And few there are that find it. We'll talk about that more in just a moment. It's the idea of the road being right in front of you and you can't even look at it. That to me is sort of the idea of the lust of the eyes. It's the fact that I know where I should be looking, but you know what? There's just so many things around me that I can't stop looking at. You know what? It doesn't have to be things that we would openly view as sinful. It can be all manner of things. If we've talked about this before in our young adult class and in our teenage class. If you read Matthew chapter 10 very carefully, you're going to find Jesus saying, anyone that puts mother or father above me is no part of me. Now, who would say that your mother and your father are sinful? Nobody. But Jesus says, if they are above me, then you have no part of me. So that means that even if I'm driving down the road and there's something that's beautiful, a beautiful flower, a beautiful field of flowers, is there anything wrong with the field of flowers? No. But if I turn and I stare at that field of flowers for 15, 20, 30 seconds, guess what? I'm going to have a traffic accident. There's no way around it. Jesus said the exact same thing. If you put these things above me, you put these things in front of me, then you need to know you have no part of me. He said it just a little different way. In Mark chapter 3, he said, see here, these are my mother, these are my brothers, them that do the will of the one that sent me. Does that mean Jesus hated his family? No. In no way, shape, or form would anybody here say that Jesus hated his family. Here's what Jesus understood, though, and what he tried to get across to people in a way that only he could. There can't be anything in front of me. Then you look at the second part. The lust of the flesh. Now, oh, good grief, there is plenty of that. You turn on your television, you know, and right after the commercial that I'm talking about is probably some disgusting, vile commercial for some other product just to get your attention. They'll put a woman in next to nothing and have her eat a cheeseburger, and they'll call that advertising. Hello? Anybody seen a Hardee's commercial lately? How about the last 5 years? How about, I saw this and I had to laugh, I'm sorry, this was just sort of some irony here. There's a company called GoDaddy.com, I don't know if you know of this company. They sell, basically, they kind of sell real estate on the web. That's basically, you can purchase, you can have your own website and all that through them. Just about a month ago, their CEO comes out and makes this big statement about how they are sick and tired of being viewed as a vulgar, smut-filled website. Now, here's the problem. This is the same CEO they've had for about the last 15 years who okayed all of these commercials with women wearing next to nothing. And now he says, we are tired of being viewed that way. Well, guess what, buddy? You have nobody to blame but the person in the mirror. When somebody asked him, now, why did you go to these commercials in the first place? Here's what he said. We just wanted attention. At least he's honest about something. See, the lust of the flesh is the idea that I'm going to present something to you that I know appeals to the lowest part of you. That lowest human denominator. So I'm going to appeal to the sexual side of you. I'm going to appeal to the I just want to feel good about myself side of you. I want to appeal to the this makes you look cooler, better, more attractive. See, that's the lust of the flesh. It's the idea that every time you turn on your television, there's another commercial for an alcoholic product, and the only people in the commercial are very attractive, very good-looking people, and the commercial is framed in such a way that if you drink our beverage, these are the people that you get to hang out with. You see, what they don't show you is people like my uncle. People like my uncle. My uncle is an alcoholic for 31 years. And he'll tell you today he is a recovering alcoholic, 15 years after his last drink. For 31 years, he put himself in situations that my father had to go in and drag him out. For 31 years, my father would tell horror stories about getting a phone call from a bar somewhere where his brother was, who had started some type of altercation in the middle of the bar, and now the police were going to come if my dad didn't show up and get him. You see, they don't put those people in the commercials. That's way too honest. That's way too real. Nobody wants that. You see, if you do that, then you have to admit that your product is not all that it's cracked up to be. Then you have to admit that your product is not perfect, that your product does not deliver on the promises that it throws out there. And no company's willing to do that. See, the lust of the flesh says, I can separate you from your reality. I can provide you with something that you're not going to get anywhere else. And what they don't show you is the aftermath. One of the best campaigns that I've seen in the last few years has been the Truth campaign. I don't know if you've seen this. This is for people that smoke. The Truth campaign. And now they've done some pretty outlandish things. If you've seen some of their commercials, they're pretty outlandish. They went outside of the Philip Morris company and they drug a bunch of body bags out in front of the Philip Morris company. And they stacked them up until they had somewhere in the neighborhood of like 20,000 of these body bags. And they looked to be filled with actual bodies. And they stacked them up, just piled them up in front of this huge mega billion dollar corporation. And then they put a big sign across all of them. And it said, 20,000 people will die in the next 30 minutes because of your product. Now that's memorable, isn't it? That's memorable. One of the things that they talked about earlier in their promotion was that there was 20% of all kids 18 years and younger will have tried a cigarette. Somewhere in the neighborhood. I mean, it's unbelievable, 20%. They updated their numbers this year. It's down to 9%. 9%. They've cut 11%. Now, I don't know that they should be given all the credit for that, but certainly their promotion, their ad campaign is attempting to do something positive. You see, that's the kind of truth in advertising that you actually need. To show them, to show us, to show the world that when you choose the path of a slave, you've got to understand what you're going to be a slave to. And then that third thing, the pride of life, the pride in possessions. You remember how we talked about a few moments ago that not everything that distracts us is evil, it's sinful. Is it wrong to have a bunch of money? No. Is it wrong to have a big old 25,000 square foot house? No, but you need to expect roommates because my family and I are moving in. Is it wrong to have 73 cars in your driveway and drive a different one every day? No. No. But here's what you got to understand. When that becomes the focus of your life, is the next raise, the next paycheck, the next house, the next car, you got to understand, at that point, it has now taken over the number one spot in your life. And anything that does that removes God from that number one spot in your life, and therefore, it has become sinful. So when John wrote these words, John says, don't love the world or the things of the world, because if you love the world, then the love of the Father is not in you. So you better understand something up front. The world is going to throw temptation after temptation after temptation, distraction after distraction after distraction. And the one goal of the world is to keep you from staring at the one thing that matters. You say, why would the world do this? Why would the world do this to me? Why would the world want to see me destroyed? It's pretty simple. Satan is alive and well in the world. Here's what Satan knows that some of us need to realize. Satan knows he's living on borrowed time. He's living on borrowed time. And he knows that when it is finally all over, he knows his outcome. He knows where he's going, and he knows what's going to happen to him. So here is Satan's only hope: to drag as many people down with him as possible. We all remember kids like that. We all remember kids like that. Do you remember in school kids like this? The teacher would say, "Who's talking? Who's talking?" And the kid would go, "We all know kids like that." Or the teacher would say, "Mr. Jones, I need to see you for just a moment." And they would step out in the hallway and everybody's like, "Ooh." Next thing you know, the teacher opens the door and goes, "Mr. Wright, could you come out here, please? That guy just threw me under the bus. I thought we were friends, man." And you get out there and the teacher says, "Mr. Jones tells me that you did such and such. Are you kidding me right now?" And he tells you later, "Hey, sorry about that, buddy, but hey, if I was going down, I was taking people with me." Well, take somebody else, man. Leave me out of it. We had a kid one time that did that, and he got about 9 of us in trouble and got detention for 9 of us. Needless to say, that kid wasn't our friend anymore. We all know people like that. That the minute that something goes bad for them, they need something to go worse for you to feel better about themselves. If I'm going down, I'm taking as many people with me as possible. You need to understand something about Satan. Yes, he is dangerous. He absolutely is dangerous. Peter said he's like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. But here's what you better understand about him. He's desperate. He is desperate. You know, they always talk about don't back animals into a corner or they will attack, right? Satan has been in a corner for the last 2,000 years. His one shot at victory, his one chance was Jesus hanging on the cross. That was his one chance. He had actually worked the crowd into a frenzy to murder the Son of God. He'd actually done that. He'd actually had achieved his goal. And then 3 days later, the tomb was empty. And his fate was sealed. And when he realized that, he became desperate. And so now he has spent every waking moment turning the world into a sin-filled place in hopes that there won't be any that find the straight and narrow path. There won't be any that stay focused on the one thing that matters. There won't be anybody that survives. His only hope is to take as many people down as he can. And so John says there's 3 different ways that he tries that. Distraction. Tries to pull your eyes off of where you know they belong. He tries this feel-good-ism, the desires of the flesh, the lust of this idea of as long as it feels good, you should do it. He even tries with your possessions. He even tries with your pride. If nothing else, maybe I can convince them that they've done this all on their own. And if I can do that, then I've got my hooks in them. And I can start pulling them down with me. Now, that's if you chose that path. Now, I know full well that that doesn't apply to anybody in here. Because I know that you are all wonderful people. And you probably, you know what, honestly, you probably don't make as many mistakes as I do. And that's all right. I'll preach this to me. That's fine. I need it probably more than anybody else. But just in case, on the off chance that you have issues with that, we needed to cover that one pathway there. Now, John chapter 14, Jesus spoke to his apostles, who were probably scared to death, to be completely honest with you. In John 13, Jesus had washed their feet, and he had said to Peter, "If I don't wash your feet, you have no part of me." And Peter said, "Well, then wash not just my feet, my whole body." Bless Peter's heart. He just couldn't help himself, could he? Just couldn't help it. He's got to stick his foot in his mouth sometime. But Jesus sort of begun to prepare them for the fact that he wasn't going to be around much, much longer. You keep reading John 15, 16. You notice that Jesus has really kind of ramped up his preparation because he knows that in the coming days it's fixing to all be over. So John 14 is really, really interesting. It's right in the middle of this sort of change in Jesus' tone. he had been really preaching and teaching about healing the sick. He had done all these different things in front of them, and he had really amazed them, even raising Lazarus from the dead in John chapter 11. And now in John 14, he changes tone as he says, "Let not your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me." But then he says in verse 6 what I think is the most important thing. Because Thomas asks a very viable question. We give Thomas a lot of grief, by the way. We give Thomas a lot of grief. But he asks the question that all of us would ask. If we don't know where you're going, how do we know how to get there? Jesus answered his question in John 14 and verse 6. "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through me." Now, the thing about you need to understand is the word "the." The. If you go back and you read it in the original Greek, now I'm not smart enough. I'm not like Jimmy. I can't quote all the Greek words to you, okay? So I'm sorry. But if you go back and you read it in the original Greek, here's basically what it says. There is one way. There is one life. There's one truth. And basically, that sentence says, no man comes to the Father except through one way. So here's what Jesus basically says. Gentlemen, here's what you need to understand. I am going to a place, but here's what you better know. I'm the only way you can get there. So you better follow me. Look at our world. Our world has how many different religions? How many different belief systems? How many different belief patterns? And are those people zealous? Certainly. Do those people feel confident in their choice? Absolutely. But here's what they failed to realize. The Creator of the universe said there is one way to get there. And that's it. So now here's what you and I had better realize. Here's what you and I had better realize. That if we're not in the way, the one way, then we're wrong. Yeah, going back to where we started, none of us like to admit that we're wrong. But it may be that we need to look into the mirror and for once remove our pride. Remove our pride in our life and say, you know what, I'm not in the way. I'm in a way, but I'm not in the way. In Ephesians chapter 2, Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8, Paul wrote, "For it is by grace you have been saved through faith. And this is not your own doing. It is the gift of God." There is one way. Isaac was the child of promise. And what I find absolutely encouraging and uplifting is the fact that you and I can absolutely be just like Isaac. We don't have to be a slave to the world. We don't have to be in love with the world. Do you remember what Paul wrote about Demas in 2 Timothy chapter 4? Do you remember what he wrote? "Bring John Mark, for he is useful for me in ministry. For Demas has left me, being in love with this present world." Sadly, I guarantee you this morning that you can look around you and you can say, you know what? That person there is useful for what we're trying to do in the Lord's church. But you know what? That other person, they could do so much if they weren't in love with this present world. See, you have two choices to make. Paul laid it out in Galatians chapter 4. He said that the way of the slave is not the way that you're going to inherit what you want to inherit from God when this life is over. It is the way of the free, the way of the child of promise. It is the way of Isaac. The story of Isaac is an interesting one for many different things, but I think more than anything else, it's interesting that the words that you read in Galatians chapter 4, the memorial, if you will, for Isaac is not written by his father. It's not written by one of his sons, and it's not written by even his grandson, Joseph. It's written by Paul. Now, what an incredible legacy that perhaps some thousands of years later, a man sat down and said, let me try to explain to you what it means to be a child of God, and he used Isaac's story. Can they say the same thing about you and I? What path have you chosen? What path have you chosen? Have you chosen a path that has kind of got your eyes off of where they belong? Have you chosen a path that may be full of things that make you feel good, but honestly you know aren't right? Have you chosen a path that says, Lord, I can do this all on my own. I really only need you on Sundays and Wednesdays. That's it. Have you chosen that path? Because you need to understand something. Satan's got his hooks in you at that point, and he is pulling you down with all of his might. Or have you chosen a path that leads to freedom? It really is that simple. I know some people like to make it convoluted. Some people like to make it confusing. Some people like to throw a bunch of different options at you. It's really not that many options. There's really two. And you're either on one or you're on the other. This morning, I hope this has been beneficial to you. Very few times do I ever stand up in front of an audience and speak something that I didn't need to hear myself. And so I hope by sharing this with you, it has been beneficial to you. I appreciate your attention this morning.